Star Chambers Show
Love
Live
Podcast.
Welcome to the Star Chambers Show live podcast. Yes, it is a great Wednesday evening here in Central Kentucky, where I, Stephen Zimmer, am broadcasting from. And joining me in a couple of minutes is going to be the vivacious, the loquacious, the wonderful Holly Phillippe. But yes, we are underway. The chat room is already getting some folks in. And the first one, just by a second, was Sandy Lender tonight. And also, let me give a shout out to Amy McCorkle and also to Moon, also known as Duan Hearn. That's right. You got great folks. And I know they're excited about tonight's guest. I am too, and definitely the return of someone that is just somebody Holly and I think the world of. So I cannot wait to get to that part of the show. But first, as this is the show that's affiliated with the Imaginarium Convention, I do want to get you all up to date and give you all updates about what's been happening in the last week. And yes, there has been quite a bit of activity. First of all, I wanted to go ahead and thank Richard Warner of HowToAffordHomes.com, who was our latest Imaginarium 2024 individual patron. Yes, these help us a lot, and especially at this time of the year, because we do get some opportunities that crop up, and that's going to be something I emphasize here in a second, and we love to take advantage of bringing more into the convention when we can. And yes, thank you, Richard, for coming aboard with us as an individual patron. If you'd like to become one, it's not like Patreon. It's a one-time contribution of $75, but they're on our website over at enterTheImaginarium.com. But we have added some new guests, and we've got an awful lot of new programming that we have added as well. So let's go ahead and give you a little preview of some of the new programming. So we have some new workshop additions. Here they are. Okay, one, how to become a better poet. And the presenter is none other than Kentucky Poet Laureate Lee Pennington. I mean, the guy is amazing. He's an icon in Kentucky literature and rarely gives workshops. As a matter of fact, when he first gave one Imaginarium a couple of years ago, he hadn't given a poetry workshop in many, many years. So now he gives one at Imaginarium. So you have a rare opportunity to work with somebody of his caliber. But how to become a better poet. We also have one from How to Utilize Scrivener. Yes, Scrivener, very popular software. Dave Weller will be giving that workshop. Creative Writing for Games, and this is going to be by presenter Brent Campbell, who is himself a writer-developer for games. He's going to be giving a workshop on how to write and develop a game. That's right. So if you're looking at maybe adapting your novel to the game world, it might be a good one to check out. Or if you're a filmmaker who wants to adapt maybe your film world to the gaming world, that might be a really good one to check out. Then we're going to have one called Mock Writer's Room, Breaking Stargate SGU Season 3. And yes, this is a 3-hour-long workshop given by James Fox, who is just amazing. He's a director. He's an author. He's a screenwriter. And I mean, he works out in California and one of our favorites here at Imaginarium. He's one of our spotlighted guests, but he will be giving an actual mock writer's room. It's a total interactive workshop, just like you hear about the writer's rooms with your favorite episodic shows. Well, if you'd like to see how one works, come to Imaginarium, and you'll get the chance to participate and find out. And then we also have, on the workshop side of things, we have It's All a Matter of Perspective, and this is going to be presented by best-selling author Devin Erickson. He's going to be talking about tense and perspective in writing. Also, Kathy L. Brown is going to be giving the three C's of fiction: conflict, crisis, and climax. So this is going to be a really meaty writing craft exercises and workshop. And then you also are going to get a chance to build out your book, make your promotion uniquely yours, and presenter is Ren Million, and it's about inventing new creative ways to market your book using alternative approaches to social involvement. Really cool workshop, going to get you out of the box thinking about book marketing and all kinds of stuff there. And then Fast First Draft, How I Cut My Draft Time by 95% from Jessica Minyard, talking about tips and tricks from a slow writer on how to decrease the time it takes to go from blank page to a finished first draft of the manuscript. And then we also get a workshop from John Pica, the magician himself, paranormal storytelling and touring for fun and profit. And he says how to turn your storytelling abilities into a six-figure revenue-generating source of income in the area of paranormal storytelling and touring. And so, that might be a real intriguing one to go check out. And then on the panel side of things, we have added a guide to writing fantasy. And that's, as you can guess, it's going to be a panel about the art of writing fantasy. Another one on creative nonfiction, and it's discussing the many forms of creative nonfiction in journalism, travel writing, and personal essays. So that's going to be a good one for you nonfiction writers. And then one called Why Contribute to an Anthology, and it's going to be involving publishers, writers, and editors on that panel, talking about how contributing your story to an anthology can bolster your career. That one's going to be a really good one. I know we're going to have some amazing people on that. And then also in the panel side of things, romance across genres. And this is going to be a really interesting romance-focused panel to be discussed what makes a successful romance novel and also how it can be weaved into cross-genre prose and used in subgenres and things like that. And it's also going to talk about several of the most popular romance subgenres. So that's going to be a really good one that's going to be of appeal to writers who don't necessarily write romance. It's going to have a lot for all of you. So check it out. And then the Ultimate Guide to World Building, and that's going to be held by moderated. It's a panel by Michael K. Falciani, and he's going to be steering our panelists to show you how to establish parameters for your fictional world and to create an engaging one. So yes, a good meaty world building panel. That's right, folks. And then also joining us now we're going to get into the guest side of things. And we've got, as I just mentioned, author and editor Michael Falciani. And yeah, he's an award-winning author and editor. Fantastic guy, great writer, great editor, very recognized award winner. And yeah, he's going to be coming back to Imaginarium. And yes, he'll be in a lot of programming. And then now, finally, I'm going to share with you one example of why those individual patrons and official sponsors and things like that are so important. We had the opportunity to bring aboard another Imaginator guest, and we were just able to do so. So, yes, I'm excited to share with you that we will be welcoming the editor-in-chief and publisher of Locus Magazine. Yes, you heard that right. Yes, she is the four-time Hugo Award-winning publisher and editor-in-chief of Locus Magazine, Liza Groen-Trombi, and she'll be coming to Imaginarium as one of our Imaginator guests. And yes, that is the Locus, the one that has won several Hugo Awards, the Locus being one of the most influential publications in genre fiction, without question. And so, this is a major announcement. If you're into the industry and into the writing world and publishing and things like that. But yes, we have Liza Groen-Trombi coming to Imaginarium. And that's going to be absolutely fantastic. And so on that note, I'm going to go ahead and it looks like bring in Holly as I get to the end of the updates here. Holly, are you there?
Yes, I made it. Somebody was popping in the chat room I was talking with that was having some technical issues too, I guess, a couple weeks back. And I told him, we hadn't had problems since December, so knock on wood, except for a couple weeks ago. So, they was working things out. The good thing about, I will say something about Blog Talk Radio before we go on, is the fact that people can call in during the live show. And so it's a live radio show. So that's why we try to stay here. I've researched and researched many other platforms, but it's hard to find one that's got the live chat with the live show and doing live call-ins like this
call-ins,
setup.
Yeah.
And we want to keep this. And you know, we do have people from all over the country as guests, and we have had foreign guests. So this just makes it easier than having to arrange for, doing a FaceTime or, video and all that.
Yeah.
Here we can sit here and everybody in their pajamas and looking messy and being comfortable and enjoying a great conversation.
Right.
You know.
Yep.
So
that's talk
right.
radio
that's,
show. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just want to put that out there. But, yeah, I did add some great programming. I am wrapping it up. So probably by the end of next week, I'll have it wrapped up. I'm working through some final workshops with some people, and then I will round out my panels and get them finished, and then look for panel surveys in May. I've already had emails about it and questions, of course, and people start asking. But, yeah, I will get those out in May. So, yeah, people give me at least till May, and then start watching your emails for that. I will get info out to vendors and all that too soon, and just giving them a heads up and welcome everybody and, a map and, send them all that good stuff. And so be on the lookout, people. And, go ahead. I lost my thought now.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, be sure to also, on that note, be sure to catch Sacco's appearance last week. It'll be in our archive on blogtalkradio.com/Star Chamber Show because she was just a trooper and very gracious in bearing with our difficult week when the platform was having troubles and not working correctly. So, definitely, if you haven't caught that episode, it was really interesting. Great conversation, and she's just awesome. And so I just want to encourage you to catch that back episode if you can. But we're getting close to having our guests come on here, Holly, so I'm going to go ahead and recognize the folks that brought you tonight's show, and that would be Sandy Linder, the Genre Blender. Yes, yes, yes. And who also is in the chat room tonight back with us. I'm excited to see. And then we also have Per Bostet Publications, Keely Harris, Marian Allen, and Sarah Marion. But here's a little bit from Sandy Linder first.
Hey, Star Chamber listeners. Did you know that author Sandy Linder has a BookTube channel on YouTube? She is using the platform to talk about books and stories and indie authors and new characters you might not have heard of before. And she's doing it all with a positive spin. Check out Sandy Linder at Sandy Says Read on YouTube for all the creative, bookish goodness.
Thank you, Sandy. You're awesome. I always appreciate you every day, in fact. So thank you, Sandy. And as far as Per Bostet Publications is a small press based in Louisville metro area specializing in speculative fiction and other outside-the-box books. With 40 titles in print and ebook formats and a handful of audiobooks, Per Bostet offers a little bit of everything. Follow the investigations of Private Eye David Blaze and M.B. Dabney's An Untidy Affair, a historical mystery set during the 1985 police bombing of the Move House in Philadelphia. Or join the psychic private investigator Alan Rodriguez in New Mexico and A Handful of Dirt by Janie Franz as he tries to clear an elderly man wrongfully accused of murder. You can find these titles and more at PerBostetPublications.com at Amazon, or you can find the press in person at In Conjunction Indianapolis and Louisville's Imaginarium Convention in July and Prime Crime in Indianapolis in October. Per Bostet Publications, where timeless tales unfold. And so, yes, we are right at the point where we normally bring in the guests, so the timing is just perfect. So I'm going to go ahead and roll into the introduction, Holly, and this is the moment we've all been waiting for. Yes, chat room, It is that time to bring back who is now an Imaginarium favorite, who we just loved having last year as an Imaginator guest, and who was also on the Star Chamber show last year. So this is a return visit. And this author is the international best-selling co-author of Dracula the Undead, which was the official Stoker Family endorsed sequel to Dracula. Also, he wrote with J.D. Barker, Dracul, a prequel to Dracula, which was released all over the world and through Putnam in North America, Penguin, Random House in the UK, and other publishers in many other countries, and became also a big best-selling hit. He conducts fascinating tours overseas connected to the Bram Stoker lore. And, yes, I'm saying the word Stoker a lot because it happens to be his last name. So welcoming onto the show, again, I am honored and very excited to bring forth Dacre Stoker. Dacre, your microphone is on. Welcome back. Great to have you.
Well, thank you so much. Great to be in the Star Chamber. Great to hear your voice and Holly in the background. And yeah, glad to be here to tell you about my latest exploits.
Yes,
oh, I know.
I cannot wait.
Yeah, we could do a 10-hour episode with your exploits and and stories. I know we could, but we won't tie you down for that long. But yes, we're gonna get into some great conversations and loved meeting you in person. I mean, I hear about you all the time from the attendees. I mean, people just loved you last summer and really enjoyed meeting you in person.
And
it was a pleasure.
Yeah.
Yeah, the workshops, which were
on the 100 years of film, you know, of Dracula films and all that. I was in on that one. I actually, you know, got to attend, and that was so fascinating. I did ask a few questions, and yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed that, and I enjoy all your research, that the time you have put into looking over Bram's life. And yes, it's Bram, not Avery, not Bram, as we were all saying. I learned that from you, Dacre, that it is Bram Stoker. And I guess we really need to touch on this documentary film. It's going to be called The Father of Dracula, and it's by an Irish filmmaker, Jason. Now, how do you say his last name? Figgis?
That's right, Figgis. Yep, that's it.
Okay. And it's written by John West. And I guess you are doing the narration, correct?
Yeah, not only narration, as I provide a lot of material, a lot of stuff that I've been researching, as you guys mentioned earlier, and I found that the fans are really interested in sort of, you know, little known facts about Bram Stoker, things that I've discovered in all my research, you know, finding his journal and other things in private archives that just haven't been put forth yet in biographies or other. I mean, there's been a few films where he's been briefly mentioned, you know, every time they do a film about Dracula, so Bram Stoker, this and that. But, you know, they never really get behind the man himself, into the mind of the guy, like pulling back the curtain to the Wizard of Oz type thing, you know, what's really there. So that's what we're doing is, I have to say, over the last 5 years, I've collected a lot of film footage, and that's been out of my pocket, along with my good friend Colin Hamilton. Anywhere I've gone, to Whitby, England, Cruden Bay, Scotland, Transylvania on my tours, we've always shot film with the hope that one day we'd get somebody to, you know, put it together. And enter Jason Figgis, who's a Dubliner, who knows a lot about Ireland and the mythology and superstitions and knows a lot about Bram. And same with John West, who's another friend. He's a big in the paranormal. He's written some books about locations in England with ghosts and so on. So we, you know, the team has come together, and I think it's going to hit the right mark. Now all we need to do is raise money in Indiegogo to pay for some pretty sophisticated editing. So that's kind of where we are at the moment. And, you know, lots more. I'm willing to divulge, Holly, a number of kind of things we're going to tell for the first time, but maybe not everything. So people still have something to look forward to.
Right. We don't want to give away all the spoilers, but we want to entice people to, you know, definitely want to check this out. And so the crowdsourcing has started on Indiegogo, correct?
That is correct. And as you mentioned just a few minutes ago, you go to Indiegogo and look for the title, the Father of Dracula, which of course is Bram Stoker, and that's where you'd get all the information about Jason and John West, myself, and what we're trying to do.
Fantastic. So, I mean, it was originally their idea, and they reached out to you, or was you looking for a company to take this on?
Well, it was a little of both, funnily enough. I approached them a few years ago with an idea to do this, and this is one of the traditional ways you do things is you put a pitch together with people who you think could do a really good job. We had a potential funding source, overseas money that was like really interested in sort of looking at Romania and the relationship between Vlad the Impaler and the Ottomans and how Dracula got involved. Well, you know, you worked for about 6 months and the whole thing fell apart. So that kind of tweaked everybody's interest. And then COVID came and John West and Jason Figgis said, you know, we can do something like this without all, you know, the traditional way of money up front. Let's do something on our own on a smaller scale and go to crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. And so they contacted me and said, well, you remember that thing we're going to do? Let's do it. But let's do it, you know, not on a grand scale, but let's do it really good quality. I am going to need to raise money to rent editing space and so on.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does take a lot of money. We did our film pilot years ago, and, yeah, quite aware. It takes money. It takes time.
Ooh, yeah.
And in your case with the documentary, a lot of research. And I know you've done a lot, you know, for the books and everything that you have written and done a lot of, you know, looking back into his past. But it's hard because, you know, like you've said, he didn't leave a whole lot of, like, autobiography, you know, an autobiography of notes and different things. They don't exist. So it's quite hard, you know, to find out. And his early life especially, and you talk about this mysterious illness that he had, and you have a theory about that and how it developed his imagination. Could you explain that? Because my curiosity is really piqued about this illness and how that would have affected his writing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting, Holly. I'm glad you wanted me to bring that up because, you know, so many authors don't lead normal lives, and many of them start at a young age, as Sigmund Freud would tell you, you know, many things that happen in the young age stick with you and come out later on in life, and manifest in certain ways, right? And you know, you can look at people with tremendous sense of imagination and who've written things that have scared the heck out of us, who have thrilled the heck out of us, and so on, Edgar Allan Poe and Lovecraft. And some people, you know, and I won't point names or fingers at names, but some people delve into, you know, sort of illegal drugs and all this other stuff to get them in the right frame of mind. But I believe my great-granduncle Bram Stoker was sort of forced into developing, or it happened to him, develop a very dark, macabre sense of imagination, because for the first 7 years of his life, he was an invalid. We don't know exactly what it was, but here's my theory, because you asked, and it will be coming out in this film. And is what I've contacted doctors who are interested in history, sort of like I am, and look at Victorian historical ailments and cures and diseases, and I've run my theory by them. And this is what it is. Number one, the Stoker family lived just outside of Dublin on Dublin Harbor, in a place called Clontarf, very mildewy and musty. And they slept on beds that were made with straw or hay covered in linen. And so if you did have any allergies or serious respiratory illness, that type of thing, which I believe Bram did. Why? Because there has been, through the generations, and still to this day in our family. And of course, I came from Bram's youngest brother. He's my great-grandfather. there is still asthma and respiratory allergies very strong in our family. So that begins my theory. And then when they moved about 3 miles away from the coast to a more dry environment when Bram was 7, he got better. When he started actively walking, as the doctor and his family, one of his uncles, prescribed, start walking, moving, you know, getting around, he started improving. And not only did he improve, but 10 years after he was bedridden for 7 years, he became a champion athlete at university. Now, a number of the family members, my son included, who wasn't an invalid, but he had respiratory allergies and asthma and the puffer and the nebulizer, all the things we have to this day, he
right.
ended up growing out of his asthma, and he rode at the high school state champion level, college. You know, he became a very strong, robust young man, as Bram Stoker did. You grow out of these things occasionally. And they didn't have medication in those days. As a matter of fact, I got reason to believe one of Bram's famous uncles, who was a famous doctor, bloodlet him, which would have made it more difficult to recover. But that's another story. So I think what he recovered from this to be just fine physically. But during that time, 7 years, and you're being told stories of the blood is the life, and you get bloodlet uh-huh. by one of your uncles, and you get drained, and you get weakened. And not only do you get weakened, but a treatise that I found written by his uncle, Edward Alexander Stoker, was the cure was not only your bloodlet, but you feed them mm-hmm. wine and oil afterwards, which puts you in a drunken stupor, like haze. You know, you'd be in a haze for a while. And then his mother told him these stories. And one of them, I know for a fact she told him, was all about the cholera epidemic that she grew up through and managed to avoid, luckily, in 1832 as a 14-year-old. She told the son, Bram, of people and a neighbor that she knew who was misdiagnosed with the cholera, thought to be dead, misdiagnosed, put into a grave with all these other cholera victims, a mass grave. Husband goes pay his final respects, and she's alive under these pile of bodies and crawls her way out amongst all the dead. The undead, as Bram uses the term later. So I think, Holly, that's sort of a short summary of what people will hear much more of and my evidence in the documentary. But this is what I think framed Bram's dark sense of imagination. And I found a quote that he actually wrote in a book that he wrote about his famous boss and friend, Henry Irving. He said, in my childhood, I was confined to my bed for 7 years, but I was told many stories and had many thoughts, which later proved to be very fruitful in my writing. So he's telling us that, you know, many things that happened during that time proved to be fruitful. You know, it's a very dry,
right.
sort of witted way of saying, yeah, this messed up my head. It gave me a dark sense of imagination. So there we go on one of the cool little tips of the hat to what people can find in the documentary.
That's amazing. And being a nurse, you know, I mean, that's a very plausible theory, and it's very true that they did do the bloodletting and all that, so that would have made sense for the time. And definitely, they didn't have the medications to help with asthma and, you know, allergies and the allergen triggers for asthma. And that would have made you so short of breath, and you couldn't have walked around much. You couldn't, you know. So yeah, I mean, that totally would explain a lot of things. And the bloodletting, yeah, they did it for numerous things back in the Victorian era. They believed, you know, that it was in the blood, the poison or the infection or whatever, and so they would, you know, drain you of blood. And, yeah, of course it didn't help, but they thought it did, and they did it for many, many years.
Yeah, they called it, fever. You know, there was just
yeah.
like almost any illness, oh, he's got the fever.
He's got the
and sometimes
fever.
It actually
that's
caused the heating fever, But it was like the fever. And what do? We bloodlet mm-hmm. you for the fever. And what do you, how much do you take out? Oh, we don't know. Until he passes out, and then we take off the leeches, you know. It's like that's very unscientific, isn't it? But, you know, people survived.
That's true. That's true. They did. And it would have definitely, as a child, could you just imagine, you know, if they used the leeches or if they just used a sharp razor or whatever to let the blood, I mean, laying there watching yourself bleed out as a child has to do something to your psyche. So,
kidding. I mean, especially if you write a story about, you know, the blood being taken out by a count who's really an eccentric sort of scientist who is taking blood for his own self. There's a lot of these parallels, you know, that could be, this is what Bram imagined as the women in white came over him to take his blood out, or the doctor shows up and he's going to take the blood. There was actually even a quote in Dracula in chapter 4 when Jonathan Harker finds the count in his crate, and he's got the guts up to look for him in the castle, and he's going to try to kill him, but he weenies out and he slips with the shovel when he tries to hit him with it, and he goes, he lay in his crate looking like a leech engorged with his, no, looking like a bloated leech engorged with his repletion. So
yeah.
If that's not,
yeah.
you know, firsthand knowledge that Bram had, how would he know what an engorged leech exhausted with his repletion looked like? It's possible on somebody else, but it's quite possible on himself as a kid.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that definitely would have been horrifying. And, you know, even, you know, to anyone. So, he went through a lot of these stories that he put in the book. He actually went through it firsthand. And so, yeah, it definitely would have piqued his imagination. That's for sure. Especially as a child, you know, because your imagination runs wild anyway. And you come up with all kinds of things. And then you bring in the lore. The vampire, you know, you bring in that lore into this. Well, 2 + 2 = 4. I mean, you know, it made perfect sense. It was a great marriage.
Yeah, he was very well aware, as you just said, of existing vampire lore. And I'll give you another little tidbit. Oscar Wilde's mother was a literary mentor and supporter of Bram's writing. She wrote a book about Irish folklore and superstition. It was in a copy that was in Bram's personal library. Inside that book, there was a chapter where she mentioned the similarities between Irish folklore and superstition and that of Transylvania that involves the werewolf and vampires. Madame Gerard has written on it. Madame Gerard is Emily Gerard, who wrote the essay Transylvanian Superstitions in the book Land Beyond the Forest. That was one of the books that Bram used in the London Library. We know that for a fact because we've seen him listing all of his sources in his notes. So in a certain respect, Oscar Wilde's mother helped direct Bram to source of information on vampires. Oscar Wilde, of course, was the former suitor of Florence Balcombe, who Bram Stoker ended up marrying, and William Wilde was a classmate of Bram's at Trinity. So it's all tied into some of the great literary folks of Ireland, and what we see today is that they were all tied up in sort of a intelligentsia literati sort of thing.
Yeah, I was amazed to hear that Oscar Wilde and Bram were connected, and I did not realize that that his mother was a literary mentor. That's fascinating, and shows that's a small world though. It really is. It really is.
Yeah, when you really think about it, the literary world, the world of the theater. You know, it was obviously a lot smaller than today, but really when Bram moved from Dublin to London, you know, they were all dialed in with the artists, with poets, with other authors. You know, they'd band together. They'd write, they write things together. They'd contribute to magazines together. They met in this restaurant in the back of the Lyceum Theater. A lot of very sort of, you know, creative sorts would meet back there, and then and they chat about things, and they discuss plays. So it was a, you know, that was the world that Bram loved so much, the sort of the creative types. And what was interesting is his family, three brothers, my great-grandfather included, were sort of the opposite. They, not that they were not creative, but they were much more of the scientific mind. And those people, science was just booming in the Victorian era, as you know, that helped move in the Industrial Revolution. But the creatives were sort of off in their own world. The science guys were off in a different world. And what did Bram do? He combined them in this story, Dracula. He had Dr. Seward, the doctor. He had Van Helsing, who kind of straddled a little bit between the two worlds, being the guy from another country that knew about superstition and folklore, but he was also a doctor and a lawyer. And then you have Jonathan Harker, who is more of the lawyer side, and you've got Galdeming, the lord. You know, so you've got Bram had this cross-section of people, but it represented what was going on in this Victorian era, all these little bits and pieces of what can the reader identify with, and most importantly, identify it at the level that Bram made the story seem real. Real horror, real events. You know, people believed in the real vampire scares. I mean, they really thought this stuff was true out of ignorance until science was beginning to explain to people about contagious diseases and so on, that it's not necessarily the souls of the dead that are coming out of the grave and causing somebody else in the family to get sick. It's either cholera, or it's the plague, or it's one of these rheumatic fevers or things like that.
Right, right. But the lore goes back so long. You know, I will always be a believer that there is something to it. But, yeah, the fact of, you know, like the souls coming back from the graves. And the Victorians would actually go as far as caging in, putting a cage over the grave, because they thought person was going to arise and come up as a vampire, you know, certain people. And so they would actually put that cage. You know what I'm talking about, Dacre. You know, they would put metal.
I've seen them. Yeah, they were actually used for two purposes, if you can believe it. One, to stop the soul from coming out, and two, stopping people from stealing the bodies to take them out to bring them for medical stuff. So they actually had two purposes. And they did another weird thing. They even invented the tube that would go down into the grave with a bell attached in case somebody was buried prematurely.
Right.
How grotesque is that?
It has happened, though. People did ring that bell a few times. You know,
saved by the bell. Yeah. Saved by the bell.
Saved by the bell. That's where you get it. That's where it comes from.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But
science hadn't come that far, you know, and people were buried alive. It did happen a lot. I mean, they've dug up people and seen the scratch marks on the top of caskets and everything. I mean, I talk about horrifying. I can't even, because I'm claustrophobic, so.
Holly, I think you and I, we shared that. I am severely claustrophobic as well. I didn't realize it till about the age of 50 when I had a shoulder that needed surgery and I went in for an MRI. I about wanted to commit suicide in there. I had to come out. I mean, I was like sweating and gray, and I wasn't screaming, but if they didn't let me out within, like, I was in there 1 minute and I freaked out. And so I've learned that the hard way, but I wasn't that way as a kid, and I'm kind of wondering,
I wasn't either,
as I think about this, was Bram Stoker feeling the same way as a kid?
Yeah,
you know, drawing the last breath. You were talking earlier about asthma. You know, was he feeling that sense of what happens if you're put in the ground prematurely, like his mother's stories talks about their neighbor? how horrible, right. horrible would that be? And would your soul be able to make it out even if your body didn't? So I sort of wonder if that's also part of his trauma. And did it make its way to me many generations later? I don't know. But when I even think about it, Holly, I get a little bit weird.
Yeah, well, it's true. Things do get passed down at the chromosome level. They have,
epigenetics.
It does.
Epigenetics.
I mean,
yeah, it does. Things happen.
They
yeah.
believe now.
Absolutely.
I mean, they haven't proved it. They believe now that even memories that, you know, like deja vus or a lot of things that you have these weird memories of or feel a closeness to, that's me in the Victorian era. You know, I absolutely love it. And I feel this such a tie to that era. And like, it, you know, if I've had the past life, that's when I lived. I believe I did. And I feel such a draw to it. I believe some of that goes back to a DNA level. So yeah, I definitely, we can inherit some odd behaviors and odd phobias, and just because it's not explained, right? You know, I wasn't that way as a child either, Dacre. I mean, this developed later on, you know, in my probably late teens, early 20s, I developed claustrophobia. And I'm like, where did this come from? You know, I'd have went in all kinds of caves and tunnels and everything as a kid. I wasn't scared of nothing, but yeah, now, I don't even like to get in a crowded
Holly Holly doesn't even like parking garages, so, I mean, yeah, it's definitely
no,
a thing.
No, because if the ones I can't see outside, forget it.
Yeah.
I immediately start to take my breath, and it's hard.
I'm still trying to figure out what triggered mine, because just like you, I was born in Canada. We made snow forts. We had a farm. I would play in hay bale forts. You know, small, tight little places, but somebody, you know, after the shoulder thing, and I was over in England, and you know, they got teeny little cars over there, and this nice family is going to take me out for dinner in one of those like little Mercedes sports cars, and it was like the guy pulled the seat forward for me to get in the back, because he was going to drive, the wife was going to be up front, and I go in the back. I got one foot in there, and I started, you know what the feeling's like, starting to sweat, starting to breathe weird.
Yeah.
I can't go in. And I said, okay, Dacre, how are you going to get out of this one? And I just turned to him and said, guys, I'm really sorry. I got to just tell you, I can't sit back there. I'm claustrophobic. And they said, oh, no problem. And the wife had to struggle to get in the back. It's a pretty tight little seat back there. But I sat up there, and it's like, okay, I got to look out the window. You know, I'll be okay if I just look out the window. I'll be okay. And then it passed.
Right.
But every now and then I get those, and I'm still trying to figure out, when did that start? Mm-hmm. You know, what happened? Mm-hmm. At what age did I get a bad experience, or did I think of something weird? I don't know to this day what triggered it. Do you ever figure out what made yours feel that way?
No, absolutely not. Now, I know I have a extreme phobia. There's only two phobias I have, and that is claustrophobia, and then I have an unrelentless, just, I'm not scared of snakes, I am phobic. I see one, my brain completely like melts, and all I can do is fight or flight, and I run and scream. And you know me, I mean as hell normally, and I'll take on a grizzly bear, but you let me see a snake, I have lost my mind. You know, Stephen has seen it. It's not pretty.
Yeah.
And I mean,
yeah,
I'm
funny
totally
story.
In
well,
a state of terror.
Yeah, funny story in hindsight. Yeah, there was an incident on our TV pilot where we were filming about a mile away from the base site on location, and you know, all the trailers and RVs and things like that, but we had a main camp area, and we were down in the woods, and I was down with the crew in the woods, and Holly had come out, and evidently they had sighted a black snake up in the camp area, and Holly's yell could be heard all the way down on set. Yeah, we could hear Holly all the way down on set.
I'm sorry. We shouldn't laugh because
We do now. We do now. But I mean, it's at the time
it was
wasn't.
A mile.
Yeah,
they were like a mile from me.
And
at
least. Yeah.
And you could hear me. I mean, that's how it hits. I mean, I just can't even. Nothing else exists around me. And I went face to face with that sucker. I went to step out of an RV, and there he was. And I scared him just as bad as he scared me. He took off. I took off. I mean, but when I was about five, my mom scared of him. And we went to hang up clothes on the line, as you did back then. We didn't have a dryer. And so we went to hang clothes on the line, and I went to walk out the back door, and I was in front of her, and she's seeing a snake. And I don't remember what kind of snake, really. I see a coral snake in my head, but I don't know if it was exactly. I'd have to ask Mom, but she probably wouldn't remember. She's 89 now, so I doubt she remembers. But we went to walk out back, and she hollered, "Snake!" And when she did, I jumped over it. And we had our old Datsun sitting out back there because Dad was getting ready to wash it off with the water hose. He was going to wash the car. And she's like, "Get in the car. Get in the car. I'll go get the neighbor." So here I am, real little, and I get in that car. And I remember just being so scared because I was by myself, and she had screamed. And I thought the snake was going to get in and get me. You know, I mean, all these things rush through your head at that age. Like we were talking with Brom when he was like seven, he, you know, all this. These weird things happen when he was younger in his life. And so these, your imagination runs wild, right? So that's where my phobia come from. So I mean, I can relate to that. And so that's why I said it does make sense that you were talking about the bloodletting and everything with Brom, because then later on in life, he's still going to think about this because it's ingrained. It's ingrained in your psyche, and these things don't leave you. And it's weird.
Pretty strong. You know, pretty strong connection.
Yeah, it is strong. Mm-hmm. And you know darn well that, like the claustrophobia, you know, I don't know where that comes from either. And it's hard to get over that because, well, you don't know what started it to begin with. So you just kind of avoid the tight spaces and move along with your life, right?
Yeah, you do it. And I think nowadays – I you know, now that I know this, I just sort of like I'm a little more cautious when I'm going somewhere and I'm thinking, okay, you know, am I going to be asked to do something? You know, especially when you're a guest at either conventions or filming something, you know, are you going to, oh, they're going to make you get in a really tight place or go stay somewhere? I will tell you one really quite interesting one. Because it has to do with Transylvania, and it's kind of getting back to this documentary again. But in a place called Bran Castle, B-R-A-N, not like B-R-A-M, but Bran Castle, it was actually the castle that Bram Stoker saw in a picture of it, a sketch of it in a book, actually two books. And I'm convinced that he used this as his model for the exterior of Castle Dracula. So if you read the description of it in the book that Bram wrote Dracula, it sounds like he's describing what it looks like in this book. So I'm over there filming for a documentary, not this one, but another one that came out on Mysteries of the Museum, there is a secret passageway from the first floor in Bran Castle to the third. It bypasses the second floor. And it was built for Queen Marie if she wanted to go from the entrance hall of Bran Castle and skip where other people she might want to avoid to go right up to what's called the library, the music room. And, you know, I stand about 5'11". You know, not a huge guy, but when you go in this thing, there's probably enough room, and it's up about 30 stairs, stone stairs, and I got to stoop down a little bit, but the width of it is about 2 inches on either side of my shoulders, okay? So it's an archway up this thing, about these 30 steps, and I've gone up it a number of times on all my tours to Romania, but I have always asked the person ahead of me, go to the top, stand up there, and tell me when it's clear to go up, because it's not brightly lit. And what really bothers me, and Holly, I don't want to give you the heebie-jeebies when I tell you this.
No, go ahead.
Imagine if you were in there with 20 other people. You know, you go up one step at a time, right? And you're inside there, and people stop moving up because somebody wants to come down. There's no room for someone to come down. So you could get stuck in there for a little while until a bunch of people who don't know each other decide, ooh, do we go up? Do we go back down? How do we get out of this darn thing? Just thinking about that, even right now in your show, I get a little bit weird. So
yeah, I was
saying,
kind of took my breath because I'm thinking about being stuck like in the middle, right?
Yeah.
And so there's people behind you, people in front of you, and you're stuck.
Yep.
And
that's
yeah,
it.
I would be, it'd be so bad because I'm a
I've
big gal,
had
and that'd be bad.
My strategy when I go with a tour and I get to somebody, my friend, go up there. Well, I was filming with a film crew for History Channel, and they say, Dacre, would you lead us up through here and talk on the way? But the tour guide, one of the funnier guys, his name is Marius, and he got to the entrance, and the whole room was full of people, and the cameras wanted that. They wanted to see how popular this was. And he joked and said, okay, we are now going to be going up Secret Passage. Queen Marie used to use this passage to get away from people. If you're claustrophobic, you probably won't make it to the top floor.
Well,
and with that, I looked at the entrance, and I started going, oh, my God. There's a lineup. The cameras are rolling. I've got to get out of this gracefully. I can't go in there. I cannot go in there. So I said to Marius, you stand right here for a moment. Just wait here. And he stood there and blocked the entrance. And as he did, I started making up something to say so that I was blabbering away so those people would have a time to go all the way up and Marius wouldn't let anybody else in. But I wasn't about to admit on camera I'm doing this because, you know, Taker Stoker, the great grand nephew, he's in the castle. We're on the film. And, oh, my God, he's claustrophobic. What are we going to do? But I got out of it because quick thinking, Marius stood right there. The people had gone. I said, guys, I'll see you in the top floor. And boom, the corridor, you know, the place was empty and I could zip up like nothing happened. But, oh, boy, right. I have a quick moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. Yeah, because, you know, there's times you have to be cool. I mean, on the inside, you feel like you're going to, your head's going to explode, you're going to lose it, you're going to go crazy, you're going to, you know, do all kinds.
Yep.
But you have to remain cool, calm, collected, professional. And, yeah, I've been in those situations, and it's difficult. It takes a lot of self-power, if you will, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not easy.
It really
so that's my brand castle, and I will tell you, one of the cool things in this documentary is I show proof that this castle was part of what my great-granduncle, how he created Castle Dracula, but I also take people to a wonderful outdoor place with no claustrophobic experience. It happens to be the top of a volcano about 400 miles away from Brand Castle. It's an extinct volcano. And you remember me talking about that in an Imaginarium when we were saying, look, Brand's notes that live in Philadelphia in the Rosenbach Museum show Brand's lines of longitude and latitude and the actual map that he used. And I've been there now, and there is a plaque now on the rock wall of this volcano showing this is the location Brand chose for his fictional castle, Dracula. The other part of the castle is Brand Castle. And then the interior is in Scotland. Also not a claustrophobic place because it is an old ruined Scottish castle with no roof on it. So I can go in and out of there no problem, even though it's got some narrow little passageways. Without the roof, I'm totally okay.
That's it. As long as you can see the outside, it's fine.
Yeah. And there's an exit strategy. And I even feel like if I had to, at Slane's Castle in Cruden Bay, I could crawl the freaking walls. I mean, I can crawl up the brick wall. But if you don't think you've got control and you could get out if you have to, then it's not a good scenario.
Yeah. That is so true. So do you think, I want to ask about Vlad.
Yeah.
Real quickly, touch on Vlad. How much of Vlad the Impaler do you think he brought into Dracula? Did he actually use? Do you think it's from healing from his childhood and his illnesses and things he had seen and his childhood imagination and folklore? How much of Vlad the Impaler, and for historians that people that don't understand the history of Vlad, look up Vlad the Impaler. He's still very respected in some regions as a true, you know, hero of the country, and then other people believe, you know, that he was a cruel and sadistic man, but I believe he got his point across. But that's just my opinion.
He certainly got his point across to a lot of Turkish invaders.
Point. Point across.
Yeah. No, great question, Holly, because that's one of these things that, you know, really good debatable source. And here's what I'll tell you, that, you know, and again, I've realized, just like the castle merger thing, Slane's castle interior, Brent, I've found this information that two books that Bram did his research on, one by William Wilkinson, one by James Samuelson, absolute records that he used these books. And funnily enough, some of the books he made little marks in the margins. But he copied into his notebook, Dracula means devil, and it means, it also was given to somebody in Wallachia, which is the province right next to Transylvania, that displayed courage, cruel action, or cunning. Those three words were used in the novel when Van Helsing explains who Count Dracula is. He also, Bram, was looking for a devil, the devil incarnate. This is no question. So he took he took Dracula's name, but he also took what he represented in that country, the devil, and he merged it with Henry Irving, his boss, who played the role of Mephistopheles, the devil, for 27 years on stage as a person, you know, as a devil person. So he needed devil. He needed a historical figure in the country Transylvania, because that's the country that he read about Emily Gerard and Mrs. Wilde directed him to, a country that has superstitions about Spirigoi, Nosferatu, vampires, all this stuff. So he needed that country. So he just simply switched Vlad the Impaler from Wallachia to the province just up above Transylvania, and he took all the backstories. So the backstories that you hear in chapter 2, when Jonathan Harker says, you know, tell me about yourself, where have you come from, and so on, and he goes into this detail, and it's all detailed historical facts about Vlad and the days of fighting the Turks and the Hungarians and everybody else. So Bram needed to attach to a supernatural devil-like creature not only a proper name, because we did see in his notes that he was planning to call his count Vampire, W-A-M-P-Y-R-E, which is an Austrian name for a vampire. He crossed that out, and he changed it to Dracula once he read Emily Gerard's book on Transylvania, and then he attached, as I just said, the backstory to make his supernatural count a real person with a real background. So a merger of two different beings. And recently, very recently, Dr. Gary Rhodes, who's a film historian in America, great guy, he just confirmed something that I knew some years ago, but Gary brought it to the forefront, that another book that Bram used in his research, Hungarian writer Jokai, he found that there was a description of the physical characteristics of a guy in Transylvania they call the Lord of the Manor, was actually described in exactly the same way that Bram described Count Dracula as Harker arrived into the castle. So it seems that there's now three little bits of pieces of information: Vlad the Impaler, Henry Irving, and the Lord of the Manor from the Jokai book. Bram merged those together to make his famous Count Dracula.
Fantastic.
That is fascinating. Yeah.
Because even writers of today, you people watch too. You learn by people, you know, you watch people and you learn by the characteristics and you learn. So yeah, doing that research, yeah, you definitely can merge people and come up with these crazy villains and crazy ideas, and it's fascinating because his just was a perfect marriage. You know, that's lasted all these years. King new movies, The Demeter. I wanted to touch briefly on The Demeter before we get back to the documentary. But I know your feelings on The Demeter. I was following all that because I was like, when we went and seen it, Dacre, here was me. Steven, I mean, everybody sitting around us were like horrified, right? Here's me grinning ear to ear. My hands are up in the air. When I first seen Dracula come out in his natural form, I said, he's beautiful. And I mean, I was probably a little too loud, right? And people probably thought, that woman is nuts, right? But here's me. He's beautiful. I looked at Steve. I said, he's in his natural form. I love
can
it.
Confirm.
I thought it was a
can
great,
confirm.
I thought it was a fabulous representation. I loved the movie. I know there was some skepticism, but I said, you know what? There was people that were talking about it negatively, probably had never read Dracula, right? They didn't know nothing about the chapter. They didn't know nothing about what the book was actually made after. They had never read it. But those of us that have absolutely adored it.
That's the same. I'm going to say I feel exactly the same way for the listeners that don't know where I was set on this. It's a great old-fashioned horror movie, good jump scares. Again, a little claustrophobic in that ship, don't you think, Holly?
Very much so.
Yep.
But fairly faithful to Chapter 7. There's not you know, much described in Bram's novel, but it gives you the feeling that of it gave me a comforting feeling of, as I had imagined, and I had nothing to do with making the film. This is not a plug for something I'm involved in or making any money out of. It just made me feel that they respected the novel and did what they could to keep as many pieces. Yes, they added a female character in there. Yes, they had to do a couple things different. They always do. Yes,
they
those
do.
People that did read Dracula know how it's supposed to end, but they got to shock us at the end. Otherwise, it's a boring movie. Mm-hmm. So there was a very original ending for this movie, and I loved it.
Yeah, I liked it too. Yeah.
I thought it was extremely entertaining. And like you said, it's not exact, but there's no film adaptation that is. And they have to fill in the blanks. Yeah, not yet, you know. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, they have to fill in some blanks and add some romance and fluff. But, I mean, I thought it was fabulous. I thought the creature and the makeup they did, the character makeup, phenomenal.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah, I think some of the atmosphere.
Because you brought up a great point. The Dracula creature was very horrific, and to me, he looks more like Count Orlok in Nosferatu than Christopher Lee does to Bram's Dracula. But are you guys a little excited about is it Robert Eggers? Upcoming Nosferatu that's about to come out.
Yes.
I'm ready.
That whatever that creature is, not only gets me excited, but gets Holly excited in the same way that I want to hear you scream. It's beautiful when you see that one too. Because I hope they make it a real kick-ass, scary Dracula. You know, not the romantic type that has kind of we've evolved into with all the modern versions.
Right. I love Anne Rice. Mm-hmm. She's like my one of my favorite authors of all time. I've got tons of her books sitting around, and I love Lestat. He's my beloved and all that. But, yeah, it's definitely she took a spin on it and did her own take, which I encourage, and I talk about that often, Dacre, is that modern authors, they need to do that. They need to take these old creatures and everything. You don't want to write it, pro bono. You want to do something that's unique. That's what gets people going. And, yeah, Twilight, they sparkle and people had to fit over it. But, hey, that was her take on it. and Rice, you know, that they have all these different weird takes that Braun mm-hmm. didn't have. But hey, that's yeah. unique. That's something new.
Well,
and we're trying to bring into the story.
Are different, right? It's Lestat
yeah.
and DeLionCourt. It's mm-hmm. it's not Dracula. So I uh-huh. it's, and the same with Stephen King and all these others
right.
who have made different creatures. I certainly yeah. do expect other ones. And you know what? I don't think, even when they do, like Luke Evans playing in the Dracula
mm-hmm.
film, where he shows them how he's morphing Dracula. Is it
up in the cave?
He
went to the cave. Yeah,
yeah.
Went to the cave.
And that's
yeah.
cool. You know, I'm okay with that. But
mm-hmm.
boy, I do like to see originality. I do like to see
yeah.
Sort of directors and producers use some really interesting thought. Change up a little bit so we're not just complacent, but I also love to see, and look, I even did like to see Nicolas Cage play Dracula the way
yes.
he did, as Nicolas Cage
yes.
would in Renfield. That
Renfield.
Was cool.
Yes. I enjoyed that
it.
One, too. Yeah.
We've seen it at
yeah.
the theater, too, of course, and I absolutely loved it. I said, this is great. It's hilarious. Being a vampire enthusiast like I am, I found it hilarious. I did. It was just a lot of fun, you know, and that's the way it should be. You know, you don't want to make a carbon copy, obviously, because he was a treasure. You know, Bram
yeah.
was
yeah.
a treasure, and you cannot copy. You know, from copy and paste. You have to have some originality mm-hmm. and run with it, which, you know, totally they have. But I did want to ask you this because I actually did not know this until the information you sent me, and I find this fascinating. I told Steve I was going to ask, is that Bram's wife apparently went to court over a copyright about Nosferatu?
Yeah.
Can you
yeah.
talk about that? It's in the documentary
yeah,
too, but can you talk about it?
Yeah, we do talk. We put a little bit in the documentary, and I'll keep this short because it was actually a 2.5 year battle, and she had to convince. This is 2 years after Bram, excuse me, not 2 years, 10 years after Bram died. He died in 1912. In 1922, Nosferatu came out. And Bram's widow became aware of it. She had to go to the Independent Society of Authors that Bram used to be a member of and berate them because she was not a member and she was a female to represent her husband's work because he wrote it when he was a member, is now being ripped off by Prana Films. They did not ask for a license. They did not ask for rights. They just went ahead and did it. And it was actually their second
okay.
copyright infringement, but this is the first one that anybody's called them on. And after 2.5 years, the German courts ruled in favor of the Independent Society of Authors representing the widow, Florence Stoker. The problem is that when the ruling was handed down to Prana Films, they claimed they were bankrupt. They had no money. So the court said, well, then you're going to have to destroy the film. Well, they said, we can't do that because the film has already been sent out to different countries, which it had been apparently to at least 4 countries, and it would have been impossible to go to those countries to force them, because different laws exist in different countries, to ruin destroy the film. The Independent Society of Authors, and I've seen all these letters back and forth, that's why I'm talking with authority on this, said to Mrs. Stoker, we can't finance 4 more international court battles for you. We've done what we can do. And we've made our case, and she could do nothing but agree. She won the court case. Precedent was set that this was the first book to copyright infringement. But the good thing is, and I will say this in all seriousness,
uh-huh.
I'm glad that the film Nosferatu was not destroyed altogether. The fact is that one copy was in America, while Universal Films was contemplating purchasing the dramatic rights to the stage play that Mrs. Stoker, Hamilton Dean, and John Balderston were showing around America and in Europe. So she made money off of the sale of the stage rights of the book, and then she made more money off of the sale of those dramatic rights, the film rights of the stage rights, to Universal Film. And she was scared to death that they wouldn't want to buy the film rights to her play because Nosferatu was floating around. But Universal went and purchased the copy to get it off the street, and then they went and paid Mrs. Stoker decent money. She did just fine financially for the rest of her life because of that money.
Fine.
And the fact is, to this day, that film is being remastered. It's been added music scores, and it's a wonderful piece
right.
of history and shows, you know, how advanced German filmmaking was at that time. So we go into mm-hmm. a little more detail than that in the documentary, but that's the short version of it.
That's fascinating.
Wow.
It really is.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I can understand it because, well, it did take Brahms' idea of the whole situation, of the whole characteristics of the vampire and all these, you know, different elements that come together. The sexuality, you know, maybe was left out there a bit because he wasn't so pretty, and Nosferatu wasn't. But, yeah,
he still had a love interest, you know, with the female.
He did
but
have
I
a
will
love
say
interest.
This. Yeah, he did. The filmmakers said at the beginning of the film this was freely adapted from Bram Stoker's Dracula. They didn't try
well,
to
there
hide
you go.
The, you know, they didn't try to hide it. They flaunted it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that isn't right. And I'm glad she did what she did. And,
well, we've got a lot. Yeah. All the other authors to this day have a lot to thank her for because she stood up
right.
for
yep.
the rights of the law,
copyright
and law was then set. A precedent was set for copyright
yep.
infringements and so on. So that's another little
yep.
feather in the cap of the Stoker family. Not me, but you know, I've pointed out to people, and my son and I actually wrote.
Mm-hmm.
An article in Scream magazine about it, and I'm very proud of that we went into great detail. We had a German guy who was a film historian, Holger Mandel, who was very helpful on that other side of the ocean, looking into the Prana Films side of the story. But unfortunately, because of bombing and fires and so on, there are no court records that exist about why Prana felt it was okay to do what they did. There's nothing that says that in writing.
Huh.
Luckily, we've got Florence Stoker's perspective because of the letters in the British Museum Library.
Wow. That's wild.
Yeah.
And he also, I've seen that Bram also had, I don't know this Professor Downden, that had the occult collection, the connection
yeah.
to Bram. But apparently he studied under him at Trinity University. And
yeah.
there was like a whole vampire scare in New England here in the late 1800s. And that's what you talk about brings the realism to Dracula. But could you talk about that Professor Downden connection to Bram?
Yeah, Trinity College in Dublin is where Bram went to university, very conservative school. A lot of people don't put in perspective what was going on in society at the time. The occult that nowadays people think, oh, it's like somebody doing a sacrifice of a cat on Friday the 13th.
Right.
Really, the occult is looking into other things going on in the spiritual world, in the dark side. In Satan's side, you know, the Antichrist, that sort of thing. Well, Professor Downden was a very respected scholar, and he was Bram's mentor, but he also was an authority on the occult, which means he did serious studies in religion, witchcraft, magic, the occult. And it
right.
seems that Bram was quite interested in all that stuff, and I think he was possibly influenced at an early age by Professor Downden. I have
okay.
seen 22 letters in a library in England between Bram and Downden and J. Brodie Innes and other people in these secret societies who are just interested in, again, not talking weird stuff, but, you know, talking about certain church feelings about things and open-mindedness of certain communities and the scientific community trying to, you know, get scientific evidence of, is there any spiritualism or is there any belief in seances and tarot cards. So all that is, you know, things that nowadays, Holly, we say it's paranormal investigation. Back in those days, it was, you know, the interest in the occult. It's just a different time and more 127 years ago. But that's really what it was. But it's like I tried to look into people who had an influence on Bram and what their beliefs and put it into context of what was going on at the time. The other thing I would quickly say is, yeah, Bram found a newspaper clipping from the New York World newspaper in 1896 while he was still running Dracula, and it pointed out about the vampire scare that we had in America, in all the New England states, that there was there was tuberculosis going around, and people had old thoughts in their mind, old superstitions and myths in their mind, and they, even though we were fairly advanced in 1896 in America, they still believed that vampirism was going around because they couldn't scientifically prove about the tuberculosis being so contagious. So they felt it was the spirits of the dead, again, coming out and taking life from the living. So that's something that influenced Bram. By all means, it certainly did, because that article had a mention of Charles Darwin finding the vampire bat in South America.
Right.
And when Quincy Morris in the novel uses some of those very same sentence, he says, yes, when I was in South America, we had these big vampire bats that come out of the trees and drank blood from our horses. Well, that's almost exactly what Darwin said, but he said drank blood from our cattle. Darwin found these, so he discovered the vampire bat. So it's no way Bram would have known it before reading that article. So those are some of the cool tidbits that John West and I have included into the script. And more detail and all that stuff in this documentary that we're hoping to get funded on Indiegogo.
Yeah, that's what's fascinating is how, think about that. That this was early American life. I mean, we're talking early compared to, you know, England, obviously. He's been around for a long time. America was still a baby. We're still a baby, honestly, but we were a baby then. And the vampire lore had come here. There was lore here about it, and they had already knew about, Stoker's rendition, and they knew about the book Dracula. And, I mean, it was fascinating because somebody had to bring that over. There was no, like, radio that everybody listened to or, you know, internet. So the world was a lot bigger than it is now. Now it's a touch of your finger. It's seconds away. You know, back then, whole other story. So it's amazing to me that there was actually a vampire scare in the late 1800s here.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's mind-boggling, you know. It really is. And
listeners want to look into that, tell them to check into Mercy Brown in Rhode Island, Sarah Tillinghast. Those are two of the higher profile ones. Jewett City Vampire. All these things are New England states, but there was many, I say, 30 to 50 state-approved exhumations in New England at this time because people were baffled and they just, you know, relied upon superstition to get them through the unknown.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody was a witch, too. I mean, you know, from
that was
healers
a part of it.
To midwives. Yeah, you were a witch.
Yep.
So, yeah, let's burn them at the stake. So, yeah, there was a lot of weird things going on. But at the same time, then, you've discovered an Icelandic and Swedish translation of Dracula that is like a preface.
Well, Yeah, I didn't actually discover it. I became aware of that. Richard Dalby discovered it. Hans de Roos, a Dutch guy, actually was able to translate the edition of it that's been sitting in plain sight that made us realize that at first, when Dracula was published in Sweden, it was published in a newspaper. And then it went to Iceland and published in another newspaper. And in both cases, the editors changed the story to make it more, let's say, put it in more context to those countries' folklore and superstition, made it more sexual, made it more horrifying, made it more fascist. The count actually came over to sort of take over the world, kind of like Adolf Hitler was doing. And that's why Sweden, was really used that as a major scare tactic. But what the cool thing about it is not only did the story change, but what nobody realized until Richard Dalby sort of brought it out was that the preface, it's still debatable, did Bram write the original preface or not? I think he probably did, because the original preface, which is about a page and a half long, as opposed to the preface you see nowadays is about a paragraph, it really tells you that this story was real and based on reality. And I think that his editor probably thought this was too close to home. And you know, with the recent Jack the Ripper murders, that it would probably be too shocking. Yeah, too shocking to make people believe that if the police can't stop the Ripper, why are you bringing in a story that is so realistic, like a supernatural vampire is going to come in and start taking out our women and sucking their blood in the same way the Ripper was so brutal to women? It's mystifying. We still don't know for sure, but we know, did Bram write the preface? I am now convinced that he didn't write the changes that went into the newspaper in Sweden and Iceland. And I think de Roos is now in agreement with that, that the editor of the newspaper took great liberty to change the serialization of the story in the newspaper. And then when it got published in the book, they just published in Iceland the same thing that was in the newspaper rather than go back to the original manuscript. So one of those weird, freaky things of history that, you wonder what happened, why did it happen, how did it happen? And it just seems to be Bram didn't speak those languages, so he wasn't able to check. And just as you say, no radio, no internet, you just can't tell what goes on when book rights are sold to a country. So there we go. Another one of the mysteries. And I go into a little more detail with it in the documentary to give people sort of a really, firsthand, idea of what went on.
So when will this documentary be available for us to view? What is the
run plan
on this?
Yeah. So the Indiegogo campaign, Father Dracula, ends. It started in April, so it was April, May, and June. Ends in June. Whatever money we make, that's the nice thing about Indiegogo. It's not all or nothing like Kickstarter. Yes, we'd love to have $25,000, but if we don't get $25,000, we're going to pitch in ourselves. We're going to find the money. All ourselves are going to put it in so that Jason can edit this thing and really make it look good. Effects, lighting, all this stuff. And then he said, if in June, it's going to take me about a month to do the editing. And then it would be available, probably we wouldn't put out in the summer because, you can't be stupid. You don't put out a vampire show in the summer. You wait till September or October. And the idea is we would first go to film festivals, make it available. What you got to do is you got to send copies out. They got to look at it. You just get accepted to a film festival. So you got to plan that. So for probably, 6, 8, 10 months, it would be going to film festivals, the right film festivals. And hopefully what happens at film festivals is you get picked up by a network or a streaming service. And you don't know that until you're there because all these people from networks and streaming go to all the film festivals to look at what's coming out.
Right.
So if it gets picked up, great. We make our money back. If not, then we start going to people like you guys at Imaginarium and other conventions and say, hey, we'd love to come along and show our film to you guys. And, you do a little panel before, a Q&A. So, yep. We don't really know exactly what's going to happen until it gets made and the reception and the reviews at the film festivals. But that's, probably going to start in September of 2024 and run for, as I said, about 8 to 10 months.
Well, I want to let you know that the door is always open. And we definitely want to showcase this at Imaginarium back to talk about this.
I just want to say, Baker, tonight we're just going to tell you, you got your first yes from Imaginarium, definitely.
Well, that's great. I mean, listen, I had so much fun there last year.
We'll definitely show it.
It was one of the most welcoming conventions I've been at, and I gotta drop a name for you guys, because I had known John Polisano from Horror Writers, and I had great respect for him when he was the president of the Horror Writers Association, but I'd never really had a chance just to sit down with him, have coffee, have lunch, and chat. And right now he's going through a tough time, so prayers to John, because his son has got some health problems, and my God, it's just not, it ain't right. But it was at that your convention that I hatched the idea that John and I co-write a story together. And it was a story that's been building up inside of me. It's my first non-vampire story. There's no supernatural characters, but he is the right guy. We are about 3/4 of the way through our first draft, probably a year away from the ending of the second draft, because it takes a while with all our busy schedules. But I'll just say this, it is loosely based on a real set of things that happened to me on fly fishing trips that I've taken and I've guided, as well as been on, and I've guided myself and have been guided by people when bad things happen. And I've sort of merged them all together, just like Bram merged many things together to make his castle and make his town. And John is really into it, and I'm so happy that he's allowing me to sort of hold up my end as well as my outline and thoughts. But it was at the lobby in your hotel, and then at lunches and things that we chatted about. And the main reason why, and I say this with all due respect, the atmosphere at Imaginarium is very sort of open to people sharing ideas. And I had a great time sharing ideas on panels, on interviews, in a way that I don't know how to explain. Some others are really formal and you're a little bit guarded or something, but yours had just the right touch of formality and informality that I think really allowed creativity to kind of rule. So I thank you for the way you run things. I know it's a lot of work, but a lot of good comes out of them too.
I appreciate
thank
that. I'm really looking forward to your new one. And so that's why I said, we want to be, we'll go on record. We're the first one to give you an absolute yes for the new film, and very confident in Jason. He looks like he has a tremendous track record. I mean, with his placements of his feature work, and I mean, everybody, Discovery Channel, Amazon Prime, Lionsgate. I mean, evidently his work has been placed in territories, including 150 countries. I mean, this guy knows what he's doing. So folks, get out there and contribute to the Indiegogo. Get out there and support it, because it's going to be top notch. And as we get to toward the end here, Baker, if you'd give us any links that you'd like to promote, and both for yourself and for the project, to steer people toward this.
Yeah, thank you for that. So you can go check out bramstokerestate.org, .com. Excuse me, that's our commercial site that we talk all about Bram Stoker Estate. All things in Bram's life, his brothers and sisters. Also, that's where all my books are available. And then DakerStoker.com talks about books and my tours I lead as well. And then something that's new and different that I've been getting into called the Stokerverse, which is a collaborative project with Chris McCauley. And it is expanding the sort of the range of Bram Stoker out of purely literature into, we've got an RPG game out with Nightfall. We have a board game with miniatures out by Crooked Dice. We've got a new video game coming out this fall from Incubate and Spacebot. We've got a lot of projects going on in different ways, getting into film as well. So a lot of things happening. Follow me on Facebook, Dacre Stoker Author, and Instagram as well. You'll see what's coming in different books and different products. But really appreciate you guys giving me the opportunity to talk about Father of Dracula and claustrophobia and all kinds of good things we creatives have in common.
Love your visits.
It's always a joy picking your brain and talking with you. And I could go on and on for several hours. Stephen knows that's possible.
Uh-huh. Yep.
You bring up Stoker and Dracula and vampires. I'm all in. So I could go on and on. But, yeah, I did want you real quick to talk about, because we are going over. We're into overtime now. People can come back that are alive. They know that. They can come back in about 15, 20 minutes after the show. It will be available and can do the playback. And anyone else, you know, that can tune in maybe tomorrow, later on, can also listen to the playback. But I would like you just to quickly give us a rundown. I don't want to keep you too long. But of your tour that you are actually doing in Transylvania around Halloween. Yeah, I want to go so bad. It's killing my soul.
Well, let me say this. That's a good way to end the evening, because I've been leading tours with a company called Experience-Transylvania. They got a website, experience-transylvania.com. Check it out. We've decided to do something very cool, because we generally have not gone there at Halloween, because they run a massive, massive party. What we decided to do is rent the castle ourselves on October the 28th. And a venture that I haven't been able to tell you about, we'll save it for another time, is I'm now a minority owner of a vineyard in Romania called Stoker Wines. And a friend of mine, Kay Larkin, has purchased it along with some backers. And Stoker Wines and Experience Transylvania are renting the Bram Castle to have a party for our people on our tour. We're also inviting people who are at the Dracula Film Festival in Brasov nearby to come. So we're going to probably have 50 people. We've got an interesting program planned, as well as, you know, candlelight tour of the castle at night and a dinner. That's the sort of the highlight. The rest of it is we are going to be going on this 6-day tour all around Transylvania to places associated with Vlad Dracula's reign, his impalement, his death, his birthplace, as well as a few places where the novel Dracula were set. And it's really cool, very atmospheric. We're actually going to be spending Halloween in the same house where Vlad the Impaler was born. It's now a restaurant and a bit of a museum, the beautiful town of Sighișoara. So we'll all dress up. Not only on the 28th, but on Halloween night in Sighișoara, in the freaking home that Vlad Dracula was born in. Now, Holly, if that doesn't, crank your whatever, I don't know.
My hair is standing up on my arms. It's killing
it
me. It's like I'm going to sell blood or whatever I have to do to get there. But oh my God, that would be a once in a lifetime trip. That would be my number one on my bucket list. I've told Steve I've always wanted to go to Transylvania. I want to see Vlad's castle. That's just like the top. Anywhere I want to be in the world, that's where I'm going
to
be.
Start a GoFundMe and get
there
your
you
friends
go.
To donate
send
to
Holly,
send you over there.
Send Holly to see Dacre.
Hey, I want to go.
Come on.
I definitely want to go see this. Oh man! Yeah,
it's great fun. We don't take it super, super serious. You know, there is some fun sides to it. But look, it's a cool, spooky place at that time of the year. Great history. It really feels like you're stepping back in time in some of these towns. That, you know, UNESCO protected, fortified cities. I mean, really cool stuff. And yeah, of course, they've got castles, they've got graveyards, all the right stuff. Yeah. And we bring a photographer along and a video guy so everybody can get good video of them to take home and put on your Instagram and your Facebook pages. So yeah,
fantastic.
If you're interested, check out experience-transylvania.com and you can see more, or you can follow me on Facebook and ask me questions on Messenger. I'll get you all the skinny.
Thank you. And if Holly does go, just make sure you have somebody watch her when she's near that vineyard, because you might lose half your inventory if you don't watch her close enough. Because she loves her wine.
Good. My kind of girl. Good.
Yeah. Yes, the red wine will flow. You know,
yes.
It'd be even better if they'd actually have a blood wine. But we've talked about before, I've like, you know, legally, I have to look into the legal matters on that. But yeah, blood wine, that would be fantastic.
Be a novelty for sure, at least.
I definitely want to try the Stoker wine. I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah, we'll definitely buy that.
Is it more of a robust flavor? Is it a Cab Sav? Is it more of like a sangria? I mean, what do we got going on here?
Well, okay, here's the short version. We purchased an existing vineyard from a guy called Michael Rottenberg, who has been producing wine for about 15 years in the Cheptura, which is the wine growing area. Outside of Bucharest, only about an hour and a half outside of Bucharest. So it's sort of like a mini Napa Valley, all the right conditions. So he's been making rosé, Merlot, a cab, a white Chardonnays, Pinot.
Nice.
So he's already been making a bunch of different wines. We're just relabeling them and then, you know, sort of mixing them, doing some blending with some of the other wines in the area to make some unique products for ourselves. So there's going to be a full range. Unfortunately, they won't get to America probably until 2025, maybe six, because there's a lot you got to go through with the federal drug and administration, alcohol, tobacco,
right,
all that stuff, and trademarking. So going to be available in Romania and rest of Europe beforehand. But I am allowed to bring a couple bottles home every time I come back. So if you're a good girl, Holly, I might be showing up on your doorstep with a bottle of the good red stuff. But it's going to be the alcoholic stuff, not the sanguine type just yet, okay?
You got it.
Yes, the alcoholic stuff. Oh, my God. I'd be so happy. Yeah. And let me put this out. Maybe in the next couple of years, when it does get prevalent here in the States, me and Steve would be more than glad to host you to do some Lexington signings. My daughter-in-law works at the Kroger Wine and Liquor over here close to us, and I talked to the Total Wine that we have here. We have a bookstore that's two stories with an escalator called Joseph Beth Booksellers. They actually have a really nice food store with a bar. You could do signings. I mean, you've piqued my interest here. Now my mind's going here.
Yep. This is cool stuff.
We've got a lot of things in mind. I mean, one of the things about the vineyard is it is being renovated right now, so that there's going to be a really nice old feel, but with modern amenities for tasting. And for videos and things, you can see how the wine's made and tours of the actual vineyards. So on-site as well as off-site, we're going to want to make sure we spread the word. And we're going to need things like that, the ability to sort of, during the right season, you know, spread the word on Stoker wines and combine those with signings and talks. And I can imagine having a short video showing people what the actual where the grapes are growing and all that stuff as well. So let's put our heads together when it's time and when we get all the right permissions to get the wine in the country. We don't want the wine to come over in the demeter and get wrecked. We want it coming over properly so it lands
exactly.
in the right place. Okay? Yeah.
Exactly.
You got it.
But I would be more than happy to organize that. I mean, I am the convention organizer. I this is what I do. It's in my blood.
I know, and you do
yeah,
it
I
well,
be,
so I will trust you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, I would be honored to do something here in Lexington, Kentucky with you, even Louisville. We could go to Louisville
yeah,
and
all over
some,
state. Oh,
yeah,
anywhere in
yeah.
the state, yeah.
So keep
but,
me in mind for that, and yeah, we'll definitely.
I will.
But I want to thank you and just tell you we just think the world of you and looking
yes,
forward to
do.
The next visit on the Star Chamber and hopefully in person at some point sooner than later. But definitely I'll turn it over to Holly for the honors of closing because, yeah, she definitely adores you. So, Holly, take it from here.
Thanks so much, guys.
Yes,
I appreciate
you.
Being on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. And, yes, don't be a stranger to the show. We definitely got to have you back, you know, to talk more about the documentary when the time comes, get near finish, and you can talk about the whole process and the making of the film and your experience through it. And I definitely
yep.
would got to hear about this tour that I hopefully, crossing my fingers, I have a windfall somewhere where I could actually go. But yeah, I definitely want to have you back later in the year to talk about your tour that you're doing in Halloween in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Thank
that's
you.
On. I'll answer that challenge. I'd love to come on back. Thank you so much again.
Thank you, Dacre. You take care and thank you for joining us tonight.
All right. Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night, Ann. Good night. I want to thank everybody that tuned in for tonight's episode. Please join us next Wednesday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Another great guest, another great show. And for the rest of the week, be creative. Good night, all.